The super secret X-37B is back on Earth. Another TFR, another couple of F-15 intercepts, and the pilot's Bill of Rights is blocked on the Hill. This is Aero News from Monday, June 18, 2012. I'm Glenn Moyer. The U.S. Air Force's Mini-Me space shuttle, the X-37B, landed successfully at Vandenberg Air Force Base in California early Saturday morning, ending a 469-day experimental test mission. The X-37B, also known as the Orbital Test Vehicle No. 2, was launched into space back on March 5, 2011. The vehicles look a lot like miniature versions of NASA's now-retired space shuttle orbiters, with a similar shape and a payload bay for cargo and experiments. They are 29 feet long, compared to the shuttle's 122-foot length, and have a wingspan of 15 feet, compared to the shuttle's wingspan of 78 feet. It also has a cargo bay about the size of the bed of a pickup truck. Boeing's Phantom Works built two of the robotic space planes as test vehicles. The military, which took over the program from NASA, says it is using them to learn how to quickly and inexpensively refurbish reusable spaceships for flight. The original OTV debuted in 2010 and completed a 224-day orbital mission. No sooner had this OTV touched down than the Air Force announced a third mission is planned for later this year. OTV-1 will fly that mission, and of course, there has been no comment about the mission objectives. Meanwhile, China has placed its first woman in space. A three-person crew, including 33-year-old Air Force Major Liu Yang, blasted off Saturday evening aboard a Shenzhou 9 spacecraft from the launch center in the northern Gobi Desert. Later this week, the team will attempt China's first manned space docking, an important step if China hopes to push ahead and replace the United States as the world's dominant space power. Well, it was a busy weekend for F-15 drivers in the Chicago area. Another massive TFR had been set up in support of the Office of the President, and two unlucky general aviation pilots ran afoul of our government at work. At 10:30 a.m. local time Saturday morning, a NORAD-dispatched F-15 made a safe aerial intercept with a small single-engine aircraft and escorted it out of the TFR without further incident. Then, at approximately 4:30 p.m., a Cessna 172 ventured into the forbidden zone and also soon found an F-15 guiding off its wing. Again, the pilot was escorted away and advised to contact the FAA for further information. Oklahoma Senator James Inhofe first introduced his Pilot's Bill of Rights, which would limit the authority of the FAA in some proceedings it takes against pilots, in 2011. He wrote the legislation to address what he says is the ability of the agency to pull a pilot's airman privileges on a whim. The bill would give pilots access to evidence used by the FAA to revoke pilot certificates and provide an appeals process should their certificates be lifted. On last Thursday, Senator Inhofe again asked for unanimous consent from the Senate to consider the bill. While he admitted in a floor speech that for many in the Senate the legislation might have very little meaning, he added, quote, "It means a lot to the 400,000 members of the AOPA and to the 175,000 general aviation pilots with the EAA, who know that with the whim of just one bureaucrat, they could lose their license," end quote. Apparently, the senator was correct when it came to his colleagues. The bill had little meaning to them. The Hill reports that the move was blocked by Senators Jay Rockefeller, a Democrat from West Virginia, and Kay Bailey Hutchison, a Republican from Texas, respectively the chair and ranking minority member of the Senate Commerce Committee, which has jurisdiction over the FAA. Rockefeller said, quote, "This bill would stand the FAA's enforcement structure on its head, and as a result, I object," end quote. You know, too often government, and specifically the FAA, is slow to react. Witness the TFR system that clearly doesn't function as it should, or we would not see these repeated violations and interceptions. Then there's the case A&N's Jim Campbell reported in last week's Airborne, wherein a pilot with an unproven medical condition, reported by an anonymous source, doesn't stand a chance of keeping his certificate. But a convicted felon can operate fringe aviation experiences without so much as a second glance from the FAA. It seems to me, standing a few people on their heads might be just what the doctor ordered. In a white paper released on Thursday titled "Leveling the Playing Field for U.S. Airlines and Their Employees," the Airline Pilots Association outlines the clear solutions that the U.S. government must pursue to create a strong U.S. airline industry and fairly position U.S. airlines and their employees to compete and prevail in global air transportation. In the white paper, ALPA makes clear that many of the U.S. airlines' foreign competitors are state-owned or heavily state-sponsored and operate from countries with low or non-existent tax and regulatory burdens. Meanwhile, the U.S. airline industry is heavily taxed and highly regulated, and current policy often permits U.S. taxpayers' money to be used to help foreign airlines gain an economic advantage. The white paper details ALPA's policy action plan to level the playing field for U.S. airlines. The union calls for a major policy overhaul in three key areas. 1, enhancing the business environment. 2, defending U.S. aviation jobs in the international marketplace. And finally, 3, enhancing international aviation safety regulations through the International Civil Aviation Organization. On June 21st, acting FAA Administrator Michael Huerta will sit before the committee in the first part of the process that could lead to his permanent appointment to that post. Huerta was named acting administrator following the resignation of Randy Babbitt, who had been accused of driving under the influence. Those charges were later dropped. President Obama appointed Huerta to complete Babbitt's 5-year term and then have a full 5-year term of his own. However, the FAA chief does not serve strictly at the pleasure of the president, as do most appointees. The terms are for 5 years and can transcend an intervening election. That means if Huerta were to be appointed to a full term, he would be in the post beyond the next election and could possibly end up serving under a President Mitt Romney. The two at least know each other. According to his FAA bio, Huerta was managing director of the 2002 Winter Olympics in Salt Lake City, which Romney is largely credited with saving as head of the Olympics Organizing Committee. But given the current climate in Washington, D.C., it would seem that Huerta's confirmation is certainly not a given in the U.S. Senate. When Aero News continues, a ranting JetBlue pilot is competent to stand trial. A shout-out to Pilots and Paws and the Undiscovered Shuttle.
Diamond Aircraft's new DA-40 Diamond Star XL includes all popular Diamond options, combined with the sensational new Garmin GFC-700 Autopilot, a higher performance power plant, and increased gross weight. This makes the Diamond Star XL the perfect choice for affordable personal flying. The Diamond Star XL features equipment and enhancements that increase performance, capability, safety, convenience, and comfort. Visit Diamond on the web at www.diamondair.com or call 888-359-3020.
Aero News continues now for June 18th. I'm Glenn Moyer. A judge in Amarillo, Texas, has ruled that Clayton Osman, the pilot of a JetBlue flight who became disoriented during a flight from New York to Las Vegas on March 27th, is mentally competent to stand trial. U.S. District Judge Mary Lou Robinson later ruled that the psychiatric evaluation of Osman should be sealed. Osman is charged with one count of interfering with a flight crew, which is defined as assaulting or intimidating the crew, interfering with its duties, or diminishing its ability to operate the aircraft. Osman could serve as many as 20 years in prison if convicted of the charge. Well, we hear a lot about pilots who volunteer their time providing transportation for critically ill people. Well, sometimes animals need the same kind of help. And for the last 3.5 years, Florida Keys pilot Jeff Bennett has been using his personal airplane to transport animals that might otherwise die to places where they can receive critical care and find good homes. Today.com reports that Bennett recently made his 1,000th animal rescue. He is affiliated with a South Carolina-based organization called Pilots and Paws, which connects shelters and animal rescue organizations with pilots and aircraft owners. Since its founding in 2008, the organization has enlisted the help of 2,700 pilots nationwide who give their time and spend their own money to transport animals in need. Bennett has personally transported dogs and cats, but he's also had passengers as exotic as a Burmese python and a pot-bellied pig named Moo. And he's taken a photograph of every animal he's transported. To reach the 1,000 animal milestone, Bennett transported recently 23 dogs and puppies in the back of his Cirrus, which put him 3 animals over the mark. He's the author of Dog is My Co-Pilot, in which he tells the stories of many of the animals he's flown to a new life. In 1972, when the shuttle program was getting ahead of steam, Rockwell built a nearly full-scale mock-up of the orbiter, largely out of wood and plastic. As the program gathered momentum and spacecraft began to regularly fly to low Earth orbit, the mock-up was largely forgotten, left gathering dust in a warehouse in Downey, California, under large sheets of plastic. Well, the model is about to have a new life. The Downey City Council recently approved a resolution that will allow the mock-up to be temporarily moved to a movie studio parking lot under a large tent and placed on public display. The exhibit is expected to be open late summer, according to a report in the Los Angeles Times. Long-range plans for the model are to be placed on permanent display at the nearby Columbia Memorial Space Center. That is, if the $2 million needed to bring the exhibit to reality can be found. Scott Pomeran, the executive director of the Columbia Memorial Space Center, is one who hopes that the money can be found. As he says, quote, "The bottom line is, this is the original shuttle, the one Rockwell sold NASA on," end quote. "And it's been sitting in the dark, lost to time, all these years." In the original Star Trek movie, NASA's Voyager, or V'ger, returns to Earth bursting with interstellar data and having a conniption fit because it cannot get anyone to answer its request to download all of that info. It was all a bit of Hollywood science fiction. Or was it? Data from NASA's Voyager 1 spacecraft indicates that the venerable deep space explorer has encountered a region in space where the intensity of charged particles from beyond our solar system has markedly increased. Voyager scientists, looking at this rapid rise, draw closer to an inevitable but historic conclusion, that humanity's first emissary to interstellar space is on the edge of our solar system. The second important measure from the spacecraft's two telescopes will be a decline in the intensity of energetic particles generated inside the heliosphere, the bubble of charged particles the sun blows around itself. While there has been a slow decline in the measurements of these energetic particles, they have not dropped off precipitously, which could be expected when Voyager breaks through the solar boundary. The final data set will be a north-south realignment in the direction of the magnetic field lines surrounding the spacecraft from their current east-west orientation. Such analysis will take several weeks, and the Voyager team is currently crunching the numbers of its latest data set. The Voyager spacecraft were built by NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, which continues to operate both. Launched in 1977, it was unknown how long the spacecraft would even exist. Today, Voyager 1 and 2 are both in good health. Voyager 1 is 11.1 billion miles away, while number 2 is more than 9.1 billion miles away from the sun. Both are operating as part of the Voyager Interstellar Mission, an extended mission, if you'll allow me, to boldly go where no man has gone before, to explore the solar system outside the neighborhood of the outer planets and beyond. NASA's Voyagers are the two most distant active representatives of humanity and its desire to explore. The edge of the solar system may still be out there, but unfortunately, the end of this podcast is a whole lot closer. I'm Glenn Moyer. We thank you for listening. You're now cleared for departure.